I think another thing was the rise of popular music and particularly rock music, and there was a lot of interest in experimenting with sound reproduction at that time. So this is what, 40, 45 years ago. If you think of landmark albums, I'm thinking of people like the Beatles at the end of the 1960s. A big technological change was recording on four track, to have four different channels of tape to make an album. Something like the Beatles' Abbey Road album is very famous for using four track. Nowadays, people record 24, 30 tracks, no problems. You can do that on a computer. But then it was a very different thing to actually have separate tracks that could be mixed together to reproduce a much more complex soundtrack. And other artists, I mean, someone like Jimi Hendrix was developing his own equipment in the sound recording studio in order to record electric guitar in a different way, in order to, this was the first time people were starting to mic up instruments like drums separately to get much more dynamic sense of how music could be recorded and reproduced. One of the important things about the collapse of the studio system in Hollywood was that it made space for a new generation of filmmakers to come in. I'm thinking of people like Francis Ford Coppola, George Lucas, Stanley Kubrick, who all made films around this time and were much more interested in using sound and music in innovative ways. And because the studio system was no longer so dominant, they found they were able to start making some important films, which really showed a different sense of how sound might be used. It's interesting when you think of a film, George Lucas's first film, THX-1138, which is a science fiction film. I don't know if anybody's ever seen this. But the sound designer, Walter Murch, who's gone on to work on a lot of Hollywood films and is probably one of the best-known sound designers around, that's the first time in 1971 that a film had a sound designer as a credit. Someone who took responsibility for making a soundscape within a film. And there are a whole lot of films that came out around this time, films like Francis Ford Coppola's The Conversation, Robert Altman's Nashville, and Stanley Kubrick's 2001: A Space Odyssey that started to use sound and music very, very differently. I'm going to show you a little bit of Kubrick's 2001 because I think that's a film that so many people would say is very influential in how they imagined music and sound could be used. I think what's interesting with Kubrick, he was actually commissioned a composer to make an original soundtrack for the film, and in fact, it was never used, or only a tiny bit of it was used, because he started to use some existing music, some very famous classical music, and it worked so well in the film that they've become very significant scenes. I'm going to show you two scenes. One is the first scene. I don't know if people know this film. It's a film that was made in 1969, and it tells a very ambitious and strange story about the development of humankind from apes to technological beings. And so the first sequence that you'll see is called The Dawn of Man, and it's really an imaginative reconstruction of thinking, when did apes start to use tools, and how might that have taken place? And it's a sequence that only runs for about 2 minutes, and Kubrick uses this classical music, a piece by Richard Strauss that had been composed many years earlier in 1896, a piece called Also Sprach Zarathustra. So it's a piece that's composed, named after the book written by the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche. Nietzsche, in his book Thus Spoke Zarathustra, is really talking about the transformation of humankind. He talks about the concept of the Übermensch, the Superman, the man to come in the future. And this has been a very important, controversial concept within philosophy. It was taken up in the 1930s by the National Socialists, the Nazis in Germany, as a kind of justification for their philosophies. This is the sound that Richard Strauss, this is the inspiration, was Nietzsche's work for this soundtrack. So I'll play this sequence. Actually got to drag it forward a little bit, I think. Sorry, I just want to get it to the right place. This is really where I wanted to begin from. Okay. I mean, he's using that music, which was a sequence in the whole composition by Strauss called The Dawn. He's imagining how might apes have started to use tools, and he's imagining them using them as weapons, and the transition from being vegetarians to meat eaters to being creatures that can kill, that can fight wars, etc., etc. I'm going to show you one other sequence from that film. It's using a piece of music by another Strauss, who is a relation but not father or son, Johann Strauss II, who is commonly known as the Waltz King. It's a piece of music called the Blue Danube Waltz, I'm sure people will have heard. It was written in the mid-19th century in 1866. The waltz is a dance. Do people know this dance? Where a couple close together and they spin around and around. Yeah. They move around and around the dance floor. One, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three, like this. The way in which Kubrick uses the waltz, I think, is, or uses this music, is very daring in terms of allowing us to think about technology, and particularly space technology, in a very different way. And I should preface this by saying, when he made 2001 in 1969, science fiction film was not a major genre. It was very much a B picture. You know, it was seen as daggy, silly, it always looked fake. Kubrick's film really changed the way people thought about science fiction. It became an important genre. It changed the way someone like George Lucas would think about science fiction. It was enormously influential on the production of Star Wars and of that whole saga, which then changed the way in which cinema in the late 20th century would function. So we'll just play a little bit of this sequence. There, because we're going to run out of time, I can tell that. But I mean, again, it's an audacious use of music, taking such a well-known piece of music, and instead of showing people dancing, he's showing a massive piece of technology revolving like the waltz. And in fact, the conclusion of this sequence is the space shuttle docking with that space station. So it's almost a commentary on the gendered aspect, the sexuality, the sexual relation of the waltz, which was always known as a daring dance, bringing a man and a woman close together and circling around the dance floor. So you're starting to see this real shift in sound at the end of the 1960s into the 1970s as people start to use music, but also integrating music with sound effects in films at the end of the 1970s. And that's where I think the technology really starts to change. You start to get the introduction of Dolby Stereo in the mid-1970s. That's, you know, so you're getting four tracks of sound on a single optical strip of film. One of the best sound mixers in Australia, I did an interview with a number of years ago, Roger Savage, and he said prior to that, film sound hadn't changed for probably 30 years. It was mono academy. In other words, it was just one speaker at the front of the screen. With Dolby Stereo, suddenly you're having four tracks of sound. You can start to do more things. One of the first films that used Dolby Stereo significantly was George Lucas's first Star Wars film in 1977. And Roger Savage, who went on to do the sound mixing for one of the Star Wars films, Return of the Jedi, the last one, which is now Episode 6, yeah? He said, Star Wars was one of the first films that I can remember where people started coming out of the theatre talking about the soundtrack. Up until that time, nobody did. One of the issues that Lucas had with Star Wars, if people know this history, you know, Star Wars was an enormously popular film. It really changed the way in which cinema functioned economically towards the blockbuster model of film release. Lucas went around America and he put all this effort into making this great soundtrack for his film and, you know, the music composed by George Williams and so on. And he found that the reproduction quality in cinemas, particularly around the United States at that time, was very poor. One of the things that he did was start to develop sound technology, and particularly the THX system, taken from the title of his first film he made when he was a student. People have probably seen this in cinemas in China and elsewhere. THX, it's a theatre certification system, so it actually establishes a series of standards for sound equipment and for how it all should reproduce sounds. It's a licensed performance standard. And at the end of the 70s into the 80s, the film industry started to take this up. Why did they do this? Again, you're starting to see a lot of competition from video for audiences. So the film industry needs to mark itself out. It needs to upgrade in order to get a reason for people to keep coming out to the cinema. One of the ways they did this wasn't to make the screens bigger. They did that a bit, but they made the sound reproduction much, much better. And it's around that time, about 1982, 1983, let me not do that, go off, that we started to see references to sound reproduction systems in theatres. These are a series of advertisements for THX, and they're often shown pre-screen in cinemas, and I suspect some of the would have appeared in China too. Show you a couple of the different ones, but these little trailers are there to draw attention to the fact that the sound reproduction in the cinema is better, it's got better, and you're probably paying a higher ticket price for it. In a cinema that had a surround sound system, you would hear the sound move spatially across the cinema. And they went on to do a whole range of these advertisements. I mean, they still run them in front of films in the United States, in Australia, and so on. So from this time, you really start to see you've got better recording technology, so you can do multiple tracks. You've got better reproduction technologies in the theatre. You start to see soundscapes, soundtracks in films, and particularly music, enjoying a new kind of freedom. And there's a lot more experimentation with how you use music in film in the last 10 or 15 years as a result. One of the most perceptive analysts of film music, Richard Altman, he writes about how going to the cinema from the 1980s and 1990s starts becoming a lot more like going to a rock concert. It's louder, there's much more bass response. He says, the 80s ushered in a new kind of visceral identification, in other words, one that's based in the effect on the body, not just what you're seeing through your eyes, but the way in which the sound penetrates into your body. Dependent on the sound system's overt ability through bone-rattling bass and unexpected surround effects to cause spectators to vibrate, quite literally, with the entire narrative space. He says it's no longer the eyes, the ears, and the brain that alone initiate identification and maintain contact with the sonic source, with the sound. Instead, it's the whole body. Very similar to the ambience of a rock concert, where you have highly amplified sound producing this kind of wall of effect on people. Now, said I'd talk a little bit about the impact on the film industry and the convergence between film and sound. I think one of the first impacts was that you start to see this crossover between films and soundtracks. I've just got a couple here. On the left, the film The Graduate, which was done, I think, in 1967. I mean, I've picked these as early examples where soundtracks start to become really popular and start to sell lots of records. So that's a soundtrack that was done by the duo Simon and Garfunkel. And the soundtrack album, you can see at the bottom, it uses the same image as the film poster for its cover. It went to number one on the charts in America. It knocked the Beatles' Abbey Road off the top of the charts. So it became an incredibly successful commodity stream in its own right, a revenue stream. This middle one, American Graffiti, George Lucas's second film. Very interesting film. It actually doesn't have a traditional soundtrack. What he used was a whole lot of old pop songs, 1950s, 1960s pop songs. It's a coming-of-age story. I don't know if people have seen American Graffiti. It was a relatively low-budget film, shot with a budget then, 1971, of maybe $1.5 million. In its first release, it took well over $100 million at the box office. It's got one of the highest box office to cost ratios of a film ever made. In other words, you know, it made back within a couple of years more than 100 times its cost. Didn't have a traditional soundtrack because they couldn't afford it. They didn't have enough money. So he just licensed the rights to a whole lot of old pop songs, and the soundtrack album became incredibly successful. And I think they actually issued a number of different soundtrack albums, different volumes of it, on the basis of the film's popularity. So it's an early example of how a film can establish a certain brand that you can then release other merchandising streams through it. And Lucas learned a lot from this. I mean, American Graffiti is what financed Lucas to make Star Wars, the profits that he got from that. And it convinced him to keep his hands on the revenue streams, the ancillary revenues, particularly for things like toys, T-shirts. I mean, all of that stuff from Star Wars, George Lucas gets the bulk of it, not the studios.